listeners, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. A glance at the calendar makes me think it's time to ramp up the murder and mayhem. Halloween looms large. Fear not, we've got a very special show planned for next week. But now, let's pair our frightening inspiration with a tantalizing new crop of crime titles currently on the bestseller lists. This show is sure to offer up some great listening. We're putting cops, detectives, and their squads under close scrutiny. My guest today, Sandra Brown, is one of the hottest writers in this incredibly popular crime genre. Trust me, her newest title, Mean Streak, will not disappoint. Why do we continue to be so intrigued by crime novels? Let's begin the investigation as we turn to page one of the book report. The Book Report is delighted to begin this show with the newest installment from Louise Penny. The Long Way Home is book 10 in her beloved series. Armand Gamache, former chief inspector of Quebec's homicide department, is happily retired in the village of Three Pines. And then, his friend Clara confides that Peter, her artist husband, has failed to come home, failed to show up as promised on the first anniversary of their separation. She implores Gamache to find him. Having finally found sanctuary, Gamache is not keen at leaving Three Pines, but old instincts die hard. Together with his former second-in-command, Jean-Guy Beauvoir, and Myrna Landers, the trio journeys deeper and deeper into Quebec, and deeper into the soul of Peter Morrow. They discover he is a man so desperate to recapture his fame as an artist, he would sell his soul. The journey takes them to the mouth of the great St. Lawrence River, an area so desolate, so damned, the first mariners called it the land God gave to Cain. There they discover the terrible damage done by a sin-sick soul. Ralph Cosham narrates.
Every morning he went for a walk with his wife, Reine-Marie, and their German shepherd, Henri. Tossing the tennis ball ahead of them, they ended up chasing it down themselves when Henri became distracted by a fluttering leaf, or a black fly, or the voices in his head. The dog would race after the ball, then stop and stare into thin air, moving his gigantic satellite ears this way and that, honing in on some message. Not tense, but quizzical. It was, Gamache recognized, the way most people listened when they heard on the wind the wisps of a particularly beloved piece of music, or a familiar voice from far away. Head tilted, a slightly goofy expression on his face, Henri listened, while Armand and Reine-Marie fetched. All was right with the world, thought Gamache, as he sat quietly in the early August sunshine. Finally. Except for Clara, who'd taken to joining him on the bench each morning. Was it because she'd noticed him alone up here, once Reine-Marie and Henri had left, and thought he might be lonely? Thought he might like company? But he doubted that. Clara Morrow had become one of their closest friends, and she knew him better than that. No, she was here for her own reasons. Armand Gamache had grown increasingly curious. He could almost fool himself into believing his curiosity wasn't garden-variety nosiness, but his training kicking in. All his professional life, Chief Inspector Gamache had asked questions and hunted answers. And not just answers, but facts. But, much more elusive and dangerous than facts, what he really looked for were feelings, because they would lead him to the truth. And while the truth might set some free, it landed the people Gamache sought in prison, for life. Armand Gamache considered himself more an explorer than a hunter. The goal was to discover. And what he discovered could still surprise him. How often had he questioned a murderer, expecting to find curdled emotions, a soul gone sour, and instead found goodness that had gone astray? He still arrested them, of course, but he'd come to agree with Sister Préjean that no one was as bad as the worst thing they'd done. Armand Gamache had seen the worst, but he'd also seen the best, often in the same person. He closed his eyes and turned his face to the fresh morning sun. Those days were behind him now. Now he could rest in the hollow of the hand and worry about his own soul. No need to explore. He'd found what he was looking for here in Three Pines. Aware of the woman beside him, he opened his eyes but kept them forward, watching the little village below come to life. He saw his friends and new neighbors leave their homes to tend to their perennial gardens or go across the village green to the bistro for breakfast. He watched as Sarah opened the door to her boulangerie. She'd been inside since before dawn, baking baguettes and croissants and chocolatine, and now it was time to sell them. She paused, wiping her hands on her apron, and exchanged greetings with Monsieur Béliveau, who was just opening his general store. Each morning for the past few weeks, Armand Gamache had sat on the bench and watched the same people do the same thing. The village had the rhythm, the cadence of a piece of music. Perhaps that's what Henri heard, the music of Three Pines. It was like a hum, a hymn, a comforting ritual. His life had never had a rhythm. Each day had been unpredictable, and he had seemed to thrive on that. He thought that was part of his nature. He'd never known routine, until now. Gamache had to admit to a small fear that what was now a comforting routine would crumble into the banal, would become boring. But instead, it had gone in the other direction. He seemed to thrive on the repetition. The stronger he got, the more he valued the structure. Far from being limiting, imprisoning, he found his daily rituals liberating. Turmoil shook loose all sorts of unpleasant truths, but it took peace to examine them. Sitting in this quiet place in the bright sunshine, Armand Gamache was finally free to examine all the things that had fallen to the ground.
We've just heard The Long Way Home by Louise Penny. Over the course of more than three decades, Sandra Brown has become one of the country's most popular romantic suspense writers, with more than 80 million copies of her books in print. In a field dominated by men, Sandra is one of the few highly decorated female thriller writers. She was the 2012 president of the Mystery Writers of America. In 2008, she was named Thriller Master, the top award given by the International Thriller Writers Association. Sandra makes Arlington, Texas, her home. Today we'll speak with Sandra about her new title, Mean Streak. Welcome, Sandra, and it's so wonderful to have you back with us on the Book Report.
Thank you, Elaine. I always enjoy being here with you.
Dr. Emery Charbonneau is at the heart of Mean Streak. Introduce us to her.
Well, she's a very interesting character and a very interesting heroine because she is a pediatrician who has a thriving practice in Atlanta, but she's also a marathon runner, and this is really her first love. She has kind of survivor's guilt because she came from a wealthy family, so this is her way of giving back. She runs marathons for charities and organizes marathons for charities, and she's out training one afternoon, and things go awry.
Tell us what you can about the mystery man who finds her up in the mountains.
Yeah, it was fun to write this because I thought, what can I do with him? What can I do with this book that would make it unique and different? You know, I try to build something, some element into books that is unlike anything I've done before. And I thought, I wonder how long I could go without giving him a name. And I get to about page 350 before I reveal to the reader what his name is. And in fact, to all the other characters in the book, because even Emery doesn't know his name. He withholds that for reasons which become obvious. And it was a real challenge to write because I didn't realize quite how difficult it was going to be to write about a character without giving that individual a name. But he's tall, dark, handsome, and very taciturn. He doesn't come across with much information. We know that he's hiding something, but we don't know what. He's reclusive and very stingy with information about himself, which, of course, makes him all the more intriguing.
Right. How did you choose the setting for this story?
Well, I'm actually at that setting right now.
Oh!
We're doing this interview. I spend a lot of time in the mountainous area of North Carolina, and I've been up here in the wintertime. I know how perilous the conditions can be and how they can just shut everything down with fog, ice, some snow. And so I thought it would make for a really good setting because the weather is like one of the characters in the book. It plays such an important and vital role in keeping Emery from being recovered and from being found. So I'm familiar with the climate and the terrain up here to some extent, and I'm not quite as courageous as she is, but it can get pretty hairy up here during the wintertime, so I thought it would make a great setting for this story.
Oh, okay. Mean Streak is riddled with twists and turns. When the reader thinks they know who all the bad guys are, you throw in some more completely unexpected twists. When you sit down to write the book, do you have all of these shockers in mind, or do they present themselves as you progress?
Sometimes they shock the heck out of me. I don't see them coming until it happens. Some of the very best plot twists, I'll be going along, you know, just kind of following the story the way I designed it to be, and then something will occur to a character, and I'll go, oh, wait, that is great. That is so good. And I know that if I have a stunned reaction to it, that the reader will too. I do, as I'm plotting the book, I do build in some reversals because I think every good novelist has to kind of know where they're going. They don't exactly know how they're going to get there. At least that's the way I write. I set out with a problem, and I know ultimately how it's going to end, but I don't want to know everything that happens because it kind of spoils the story for me. And so I do build in some high points, some reversals that I know will get the main characters into even deeper trouble. And just when they get their problem solved, you know, there's another problem that's even bigger than the last one. But then there have been times where I was surprised and I went, oh, gosh, didn't see that one coming. And so that's what makes fiction writing so much fun.
We're speaking with Sandra Brown on The Book Report. I love the way you kept suspicion on Emery's husband. How did you maintain the subtlety of that?
That was also a challenge. Because I did write scenes from his point of view, and if that individual is the villain, it's kind of hard to do without giving away too much information, spoil, you know, things to come.
You've written more than 64 books. Where do you keep finding inspiration for each new story?
Well, I think, you know, life in our world and what happens outside of my office inspires me because you can watch one newscast. There are 12 stories that are worse than anything I could possibly create. And so our world is so rife with a lot of bad things happening to people, a lot of evil being done to people, and always mystery, intrigue, you know, brutality. And unfortunately, all of these make for good, you know, topics for thrillers. There are some subjects which I absolutely avoid that I would have put myself, much less a character, through. As a fiction writer, I'm kind of tuned to everything that's going on because the things that interest everyone else interests me, and vice versa. And so, you know, I can, the most bizarre story, I will say, that's interesting, but what if this had happened? Or what if that had happened? And put a different spin on it. And that's where I come up with a lot of ideas. It's just taking things that happen that I've heard about happening in real life and then saying, how did those two people get in that situation?
Yeah. Well, in your genre, do you think it's more difficult for a woman author to make it to the top of the bestseller list? It seems to me that thriller readers sometimes reach for the guys first.
Yeah, I think it is, because there has to be a certain amount of grit in each story, or it's not going to be a thriller. I think, however, that every book should thrill the reader. So I think we're cracking and hopefully tearing down that gender barrier. I get a lot of crossover readers who are men, and a lot of crossover readers from generation to generation. It's a genre that's really grown over the past few years, and I'm happy to be writing in that genre. I'm happy to be one of the one person considered a thriller writer.
Right. You've transitioned from another popular genre. Why the change, and do you ever think to go back to those books?
Well, I feel as though I never abandoned anything. I just brought elements of that with me. I think the worst thing that a writer can do is pigeonhole themselves, because it's hard enough for people in marketing or people in the publishing industry to pigeonhole you, even booksellers. You know, what section of the bookstore can your books be found in? And so what I've tried to do is bring all of the elements that I learned and cultivated in romance into the thriller.
Are you already at work on your next book?
Yes, I am.
Right.
I'm in the process of plotting it right now. Well, I want everyone to read Mean Streak. I think you'll find it has a lot of tension in a lot of different areas, the sexual tension plus the suspense and what's going on down the mountain as well as what's going on top of the mountain. And so I hope everyone will enjoy it.
Well, I know I did. Thanks so much for joining us today, Sandra.
Thanks, Elaine.
Alrighty, bye.
Bye.
And now, let's listen to a sampling of Mean Streak, performed by Jonathan Davis.
She gave the mother a sympathetic smile. A sick child is no fun for anybody. Try to get some rest yourself. I hope you're going someplace fun for the weekend. I'm doing a 20-mile run. That sounds like torture. She smiled. That's the point. Outside the examination room, Emery filled out the prescription form and finished her notes in the patient file. As she handed it over to the office assistant who checked out patients, the young woman said, "That was your last of the day." "Yes, and I'm on my way out." "Did you notify the hospital?" She nodded. "And the answering service. I'm officially signed out for the weekend. Are doctors Butler and James with patients?" "They are, and both have several in the waiting room. I hoped to see them before I left, but I won't bother them." "Dr. Butler left you a note?" She passed her a sheet from a monogrammed notepad. "Break a leg." "Or is that what you say to a marathon runner?" Emery smiled as she folded the note and put it in her lab coat pocket. The receptionist said, "Dr. James asked me to tell you to watch out for bears." Emery laughed. "Do their patients know they're a couple of clowns?" "Tell them I said goodbye." "Will do. Have a good run." "Thanks. See you Monday." "Oh, I almost forgot. Your husband called and said he was leaving work and would be at home to see you off." "Emery? In here." As Jeff walked into the bedroom, she zipped up her duffel bag and, with a motion that was intentionally defiant, pulled it off the bed and slid the strap onto her shoulder. "You got my message? I didn't want you to leave before I got here to say goodbye. I want to get ahead of Friday afternoon traffic." "Good idea." He looked at her for a moment, then said, "You're still mad, aren't you?" "I'd be lying if I said I wasn't." Last night's argument was still fresh. Words shouted in anger and resentment seemed to be reverberating off the bedroom walls even now, Hours after they'd gone to bed, lying back to back, each nursing hostility that had been simmering for months and had finally come to a boil. He said, "Do I at least get points for wanting to see you off?" "That depends." "On?" "On whether or not you're hoping to talk me out of going." He sighed and looked away, and she said, "That's what I thought." "Emery, you should have stayed and finished out your day at the office, because I'm going, Jeff. In fact, even if I hadn't planned this distance run for tomorrow, I'd still want to take some time for myself. A night spent away from each other will give us a chance to cool off. If the run wears me out, I may stay up there tomorrow night, too. One night or two won't change my mind. This compulsion of yours, this is where we started last night. I'm not going to rehash the quarrel now." Her training schedule for an upcoming marathon had been the subject that sparked the argument, but she feared that more substantive issues had been the underlying basis for it. The marathon wasn't their problem, the marriage was. Which is why she wanted so badly to get away and think. "I wrote down the name of the motel where I'll be tonight." As they walked past the kitchen bar, she tipped her head down toward the sheet of paper lying on it. "Call me when you get there. I want to know you made it safely." "All right." She slid on her sunglasses and opened the back door. "Goodbye." "Emery." Poised on the threshold, she turned. He leaned down and brushed his lips across hers. "Be careful."
We've just heard Mean Streak by Sandra Brown. If, like me, you are missing Stieg Larsson, The Book Report thinks you'll enjoy giving UC Adler Olson a listen. The Margot Effect, Department Q, Book 5, is a wonderful immersion into Danish culture, blended with crime noir. All 15-year-old Marco Jameson wants is to become a Danish citizen and go to school like a normal teenager. But his uncle Zola rules his former gypsy clan with an iron fist. Zola forces the children of the clan to beg and steal for his personal gain. When Marco discovers a dead body, proving the true extent of Zola's criminal activities, the boy goes on the run. But his family members aren't the only ones who'll go to any lengths to keep Marco silent forever. Meanwhile, Detective Carl Mork learns a teen named Marco may have insight into the troubling new case. He becomes determined to solve the mystery and save the boy. Carl's actions propel his team into a case that extends from Denmark to Africa, from embezzlers to child soldiers, from seemingly petty crime rings to the very darkest of cover-ups. Graham Malcolm narrates.
When Louis wasn't fighting for the future of the Baka, he was fighting for the animals of the forest. Every village surrounding the Baka's jungle fostered young Bantus armed with rifles, and every day scores of mandrill and antelope fell prey to their bullets. Though relations were tense between Louis and the poachers, he remained pragmatic enough not to turn down a lift through the bush on the back of one of their motorcycles. 3 kilometers along narrow paths to the Baka village in just 6 minutes. Who could say no when time was of the essence? Even as the mud-built huts appeared in front of them, Louis knew what had happened, for only the smallest of the children and hungry dogs came running out to greet him. Louis found the village chief lying flat out on a bed of palm leaves, a cloud of alcohol fumes lingering in the air above. Strewn on the ground around the semi-conscious Mulungu were empty whiskey bottles like the ones they thrust into your face on the other side of the river. There was no doubt the binge had gone on through the night, and judging by the silence that prevailed, it seemed equally plain that just about all the villagers had taken part. He poked his head inside the overpopulated huts of mud and bowed palm branches, finding only a few adults capable of acknowledging his presence with a sluggish nod in his direction. "This is how they make the natives toe the line and keep their mouths shut," he thought. "Just give them alcohol and drugs, and they'd be in the palm of your hand." That was it, exactly. He went back to the musty hut and kicked the chief hard in the side, causing Malungo's wiry body to give a start. A sheepish smile revealed a set of needle-sharp teeth, but Louis wasn't about to be appeased. He gestured towards the litter of bottles. "What did you do for the money, Mulungu?" he asked. The Baka chief lifted his head and gave a shrug. Reason was a concept not much used in the bush. "Mbomo gave you the money, didn't he? How much did he give you?" 10,000 francs, came the reply. Exact sums, especially of this order, were by contrast a matter in which the Baka took considerable interest. Louis nodded. That bastard Mbomo. Why had he done it? 10,000, he said. And how often does Mbomo do this? Mulungu shrugged again. Time was a relative concept. I see you people haven't planted the new crops as you are supposed to. Why not? The money has not arrived, Louis. You know that, surely? Not arrived, Mulungu. I've seen the transfer documents myself. The money was sent more than a month ago. What had happened? This was the third time reality had failed to match up with the paperwork. Louis raised his head. Beyond the sibilant song of the cicadas, an alien sound became audible. As far as he could make out, it was a small motorcycle. Mboma was already on his way. Louis would bet on it. Perhaps he came to offer a plausible explanation. Louis hoped so. He looked around. Something was certainly not right here, to say the least, but that would soon change. For although Mboma was a head taller than Louis and had arms as strong as a gorilla's, Louis was not afraid of him. If the Baka were unable to answer his questions, the big man could do so himself. Why had he come? Where was the money? Why had they not begun to plant? And who was the white man Mbomo had been with? That's what he wanted to know. So he stood on the open ground in the middle of the village and waited as the cloud of dust that rose up above the steaming bush slowly approached. Even before Mbomo dismounted, Louis would go to meet him, throw his arms wide and confront him. He would threaten him with brimstone and fire and exposure to the authorities. He would tell him to his face that if he had been embezzling funds intended to help secure the Baka's existence here in the forest, the next thing Mboma would lay his itchy fingers on would be the bars of a cell in the Kondengui prison.
We've just heard The Marco Effect by UC Adler Olson. At an auction house in Bath, England, a large slab of carved stone is up for sale. At the height of what turns into very competitive bidding, there's a holdup attempt by three masked raiders who try to steal the stone. They shoot and kill the highest bidder, a professor who's recognized the female figure carved in the stone as the wife of Bath from Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. The masked would-be thieves flee, leaving the stone behind. In The Stone Wife by Peter Lovesey, Peter Diamond and his team are assigned to investigate. The stone is moved into Diamond's office. As he researches the origins of the carving, troubles begin, and Diamond wonders if the statue has a curse. The story darkens as Diamond's leads take him to Chaucer's house in Somerset. The wonderfully talented Simon Preble performs the book.
Sturgis, the dealer from London, began in a lofty tone that irritated Diamond straight away. "I hope the police are competent to deal with this. John Gildersleeve was a leading authority on Chaucer. He's a dead man. That doesn't alter anything. It altered him. He's not the leading authority on anything now." Sturgis gritted his teeth, obviously more used to dealing with connoisseurs than smart-mouthed policemen. "I'm saying the reason for his death may have to do with his field of expertise. It was murder, whichever way you look at it. That's my field of expertise. But one needs to know what the motive might have been, which is why I'm interviewing you, Mr. Sturgis. I'm not a Chaucer expert." "You're not?" A shake of the head. "You knew enough to bid well above the valuation. Are you acting for someone else?" "Certainly. My firm wouldn't bid at that level without instructions." "Who from?" "No comment." Diamond blinked in surprise. Sturgis raised his chin defiantly. "Wild horses wouldn't drag the name from me. Client confidentiality." "I don't think I'm getting through to you," Diamond said. "Do you see what's going on across the room? That's a forensic pathologist examining a murder victim. I'm the chief investigating officer, and you're a witness. Don't talk to me about client confidentiality. The name isn't relevant anyway, Sturgis said. I'll be the judge of that. I could do you for withholding information. I won't be bullied. Diamond took that as a challenge. Were you hoping to return to London tonight? Sturgis turned pale. You wouldn't detain me. Tonight, tomorrow, and next week if necessary. Don't look so alarmed. We allow you to contact your solicitor. Threats have to carry conviction, and Diamond issued this unlikely one as coolly as if he were stating the time of day. There was an immediate change of tone. Officer, I'd better explain. I've no wish to put myself on the wrong side of the law. It's just that our whole business is founded on good faith, respecting the confidence of clients. To reveal the name of a potential buyer would be ruinous to our reputation. It might mean losing not merely the account in question, but numbers of others when they learn that the trust has been broken. So who is it? Diamond said. Weren't you listening? I'm not at liberty to say. Carry on like this, my friend, and you won't be at liberty, full stop. The man was shaken, but he wasn't about to cough. I don't see why you need to know it. That's pretty obvious, I would have thought, Diamond said, his patience exhausted. There were two bidders left in this auction, and one was murdered. The survivor has some explaining to do. But the people who killed him weren't bidding. We don't know who they were acting for. Can't you take my word as a gentleman that it's impossible for my client to have been involved? Diamond shook his head. This is beyond a joke, Sturgis said. May I make a phone call? To tip off your client? This was received with an icy stare. To my office to explain the impossible position I find myself in. Go ahead. I'll be listening. He could see this nonsense going on indefinitely, and he reckoned Sturgis was a minor player. Whoever was on the other end of the call took some convincing. But Sturgis was a man in a fix, explaining that he was facing arrest with all the damage that would do to the good name of the firm. Finally, he switched off, pulled at his tie as if it was strangling him, and said, "This must be in the strictest confidence." Diamond waited. Sturgis glanced to right and left before saying in little more than a whisper, "I was bidding on behalf of..." He mouthed the words.
"Come again?"
As if he was in breach of the Official Secrets Act, he put his mouth within 6 inches of Diamond's ear and said, "The British Museum." A moment was needed to absorb this.
That was The Stone Wife by Peter Lovesey. The Book Report is pleased to bring you the newest title from favorite John Sandford. Deadline is book 8 in the Virgil Flowers series. In southeast Minnesota, down on the Mississippi, a school board meeting is coming to an end. The board chairman announces the rest of the meeting will be closed due to personnel issues. Issues seems an understatement. The proposal up for a vote is whether to authorize the killing of a local reporter. The vote is 4-1 in favor. Meanwhile, not far away, Virgil Flowers is helping out a friend by looking into a dog napping, which seems to be turning into something much bigger and uglier. Then he gets a call from Lucas Davenport. A murdered body has been found. The victim, a local reporter. Eric Conger narrates.
At 10 o'clock the next morning, Virgil kissed Frankie goodbye and walked out to his truck, which was parked at the curb with the boat already hooked up. Virgil was recently back from New Mexico, where he caught and released every tiger muskie in what he suspected was the remotest muskie lake in North America. Nice fish, too. The biggest a finger width short of 50 inches. He could still smell them as he walked past the boat and climbed into the cab of his Forerunner. The day was warm and promising hot. The sun was doing its job out in front of the truck, but the sky had a sullen gray look about it. There'd been a quarter inch of rain over the past 24 hours, and as he rolled out of Mankato, Minnesota, the countryside looked notably damp. But it was August, the best time of the year, and he was on the road, operating, elbow out the window, pheasants running across the road in front of him. Nothing to complain about. As Virgil rode along, he thought about Frankie. He'd known her as Ma Nobles before he'd fallen into bed with her, because she had about 100 children, or at least it felt that way. She was a compelling armful, and Virgil's thoughts had drifted again to marriage, as they had 3 times before. The first 3 had been disasters, because he thought he had poor taste in women. He reconsidered. No, that wasn't quite right. His 3 wives had all been pretty decent women, but he thought he was simply a poor judge of the prospects for compatibility. He and Frankie did not have that problem. They just got along. And Virgil thought about Lucas Davenport for a while. Davenport was his boss at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. And not a bad guy, though a trifle intense. There was a distinct possibility that he wouldn't be pleased with the idea of Virgil working a dog-napping case, especially since the shit had hit the fan up north, where a couple of high school kids had tripped over an abandoned farm cistern full of dead bodies. But Johnson Johnson was a hard man to turn down. Virgil thought he might be able to sneak in a couple good working days before Davenport even found out what he was doing. A dog napping, he thought, shouldn't take too much time, one way or the other. The dogs might already be in Texas chasing armadillos, or whatever it was they chased in Texas. Dog napping. He'd had calls on it before, though he'd never investigated one, and they'd always been during hunting season, or shortly before. Didn't usually see one this early in the year. Johnson Johnson ran a lumber mill, specializing in hardwood timber. 3 varieties of oak, bird's eye maple, butternut, hickory, and some walnut and cherry, for flooring and cabinetry, with a side business of providing specialty cuts for sculptors. He and Virgil had met at the University of Minnesota, where they were studying women and baseball. Virgil had been a fair third baseman for a couple years, while Johnson was a better-than-fair catcher. He might even have caught on to the bottom edge of the pros if baseball hadn't bored him so badly. Johnson's mill was a mile outside Tripton, Minnesota, in Buchanan County, in the Driftless area along the Mississippi River.
That was a sampling of Deadline by John Sanford. From Iris Johansson, best-selling author of the Eve Duncan series, comes an explosive new standalone thriller, The Perfect Witness. She had the perfect life, the perfect cover. She was the perfect witness until they found her. The Perfect Witness centers around a woman with a photographic memory who's lived her life in the Witness Protection Program. Now, years later, her cover is blown. She's forced to go on the run, and the lives of those she holds dear hang in the balance. Elizabeth Rogers narrates.
She hesitated, only for a second, then took off running again. She didn't know what was going on, but it couldn't be worse than what she was facing now. He was a stranger, but strangers couldn't be any more dangerous than those people with whom she'd spent her entire life. Mother, don't think of her. It hurt too much. Keep running. She heard a scream behind her, then a curse, then another sound that was like a grunt. Had Tantona killed him? The wet shrubs were striking her face as she ran up the hill. Get away. He had told her to wait, but he was probably a dead man. If he wasn't, he could be just as much a danger to her as the men who had shot her. She couldn't trust him. She couldn't trust anyone.
Damn it! Stop!
The stranger's voice behind her.
You're okay now. No one's chasing you. Correction. No one but me. Stop!
She kept running. 2 minutes later, he tackled her from behind and took her down. She rolled over, and her fist struck out and hit his mouth. Then she butted her head up and struck his chest as hard as she could. Dizzy. Her head was spinning, but she tried to do it again. He muttered a curse as he straddled her and pinned her shoulders to the ground.
I'm not going to hurt you, you little tarantula.
No, you're not, she said fiercely, and moved her head so that she could sink her teeth into his hand on her shoulder. He didn't move, but said through clenched teeth,
"Get your fangs out of me, or I'll knock you out and explain later. Do you want me to prove that I'm not one of Kamano's errand boys? I will. No problem. Let's go down the hill, and I'll show you their bodies."
She stiffened and removed her teeth from his hand.
"That doesn't prove you're not just as bad."
She was silent, looking up at him.
"Did you really kill them?"
He shrugged.
"It was the only way to stop them. Kamano had given them orders. He would have taken you alive, but he'd be relieved if you were dead."
"How do you know what Kamano wants or doesn't want?"
"Not because I belong to his fine organization. He's as dirty a gangster as your father was before him. I don't give a damn about him."
He met her eyes.
"But I do give a damn about you. I want to help you."
"I don't know you. Get off me."
"Then let me introduce myself. My name is Andre Mandak, and I'll get off you if you promise you won't kick me in the nuts or run away, and if you let me take a look at that wound and stop the bleeding."
"Why would you want to do anything to help me?"
"I don't know you." "You've said that before. Maybe I'm just a good Samaritan." "I know you're scared, but think. I saved your life. Why would I want to take it now?"
"I don't trust you."
"You don't trust anyone. Deal with it. I'm the only game in town."
She stared up at him, then slowly nodded.
"Get off me."
He swung off her and helped her to her feet.
"I'll take you to my car on the road and see if I can stop that bleeding, and..."
"I'm not getting into any car," she said flatly. "And how do I know that you really did kill those men who were after me? Maybe it's a lie to trick me." She started back down the hill. "I want to see them for myself."
"Really?"
He followed her.
"Are you sure? Corpses aren't a pleasant sight."
"I have to know if you lied to me." Her hand was holding the wound in her side. It was wet with blood, pain. She had to keep on going.
"If you work for Kamano too, I don't think you'd kill his men. It wouldn't make sense. So I might be able to trust you to..."
"No, but maybe I could..." She stopped again. She wasn't thinking clearly. She whirled to face him.
"But you took away that club I had. If you really want to help me, give me your gun or something else to protect myself if you've lied to me."
We've just heard The Perfect Witness by Iris Johansson. In Tammy Hoag's A Thin Dark Line, Tara stalks the streets of Bayou Bro, Louisiana. A suspected murderer is free on a technicality, and the cop accused of planting evidence against him is ordered off the case. But Detective Nick Fourcade refuses to walk away. He's stepped over the line before, and this case threatens to push him over the edge. He's not the only one. Deputy Annie Broussard found the woman's mutilated body. She still hears the phantom echoes of dying screams. She wants justice. But pursuing the investigation will mean forming an alliance with a man she doesn't trust and making enemies of the men she works with. It will mean being drawn into the confidence of a killer. For Annie, finding justice will mean risking everything, including her life. Karen Peaks performs the book.
Like every other deputy in the sheriff's office, she had hoped against hope that Kudrow would fail in his attempt to get the ring thrown out as evidence. They had all hoped Smith Pritchett would be the one crowing on the courthouse steps. Sergeant Hooker's voice crackled over the portable radio. "Savoy, Mullen, Prigent, Broussard, move in front of those reporters. Establish some distance between the crowd." Annie edged her way between bodies, her hand resting on the butt of her baton, her eyes on Marcus Renard as Goudreau began to speak. He stood beside his attorney, looking uncomfortable with the attention being focused on him. He wasn't a man to draw notice. Quiet, unassuming, an architect in the firm of Bowen and Briggs. Not ugly, not handsome. Thinning brown hair neatly combed and hazel eyes that seemed a little too big for their sockets. He stood with his shoulders stooped and his chest sunken, a younger shadow of his attorney. His mother stood on the step above him, a thin woman with a startled expression and a mouth as tight and straight as a hyphen.
"Some people will call this ruling a travesty of justice," Kudrow said loudly. "The only travesty of justice here has been perpetrated by the Partou Parish Sheriff's Department. Their investigation of my client has been nothing short of harassment. Two prior searches of Mr. Renard's home produced nothing that might tie him to the murder of Pamela Bichon."
"Are you suggesting the Sheriff's Department manipulated evidence?" a reporter called out.
"Mr. Renard has been the victim of a narrow and fanatical investigation led by Detective Nick Foucault. Y'all are aware of Foucault's record with the New Orleans Police Department, of the reputation he brought with him to this parish. Detective Foucault allegedly found that ring in my client's home. Draw your own conclusions."
As she elbowed past a television cameraman, Annie could see Foucault turning around, half a dozen steps down from Kudrow. The cameras focused on him hastily. His expression was a stone mask, his eyes hidden by a pair of mirrored sunglasses. A cigarette smoldered between his lips. His temper was a thing of legend. Rumors abounded throughout the department that he was not quite sane. He said nothing in answer to Kudrow's insinuation, and yet the air between them seemed to thicken. Anticipation held the crowd's breath. Foucault pulled the cigarette from his mouth and flung it down, exhaling smoke through his nostrils. Annie took a half step toward Kudrow, her fingers curling around the grip of her baton. In the next heartbeat, Foucault was bounding up the steps, straight at Renard, shouting, "No!
He'll kill him!"
someone shrieked.
"Foucault!"
Hooker's voice boomed as the fat sergeant lunged after him, grabbing at and missing the back of his shirt.
"You killed her! You killed my baby girl!"
The anguished shouts tore from the throat of Hunter Davidson, Pamela Bichon's father, as he hurled himself down the steps at Renard, his eyes rolling, one arm swinging wildly, the other hand clutching a .45. Foucault knocked Renard aside with a beefy shoulder, grabbed Davidson's wrist, and shoved it skyward as the .45 barked out a shot and screams went up all around. Annie hit Davidson from the right side, her much smaller body colliding with his just as Foucault threw his weight against the man from the left. Davidson's knees buckled, and they all went down in a tangle of arms and legs, grunting and shouting, bouncing hard down the steps, Annie at the bottom of the heap. Her breath was pounded out of her as she hit the concrete steps with 400 pounds of men on top of her.
"He killed her,"
Hunter Davidson sobbed, his big body going limp.
"He butchered my girl."
Annie wriggled out from under him and sat up, grimacing. All she could think was that no physical pain could compare with what this man must have been enduring.
We've just heard A Thin Dark Line by Tammy Hoag. Readers, crime does pay when you're looking for a book that keeps you turning those pages. For a closer look at the books folks are reading and talking about, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining me today, and remember to join in our special literary salute to Halloween. The titles will be smart, scary, and really good fun. See you next week on The Book Report.